From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in May when students at Columbia Grammar and Preparatory School sat down for a lesson. The students were all juniors in high school, and they were introduced to a series of new lessons. Lessons on porn literacy. According to the New York Post, some parents were fuming. The Post reported that students thought the health and sexuality workshop was going to be about condoms or birth control. Instead, the instructor allegedly covered different genres of porn and subjects like, quote, three big male vulnerabilities, statistics on the, quote, orgasm gap between straight women and their partners versus gay men and women, and photos of partially nude women with the goal of examining the difference between porn and art. A number of students were upset. One told the Post that she already knew about porn, and she was upset she had to miss an AP class to attend this workshop. One parent said, quote, it's outrageous that the school is introducing pornography into a mainstream classroom and starting to indoctrinate kids. The goal of this is to disrupt families, end quote. The Atlantic's Elizabeth Brunig wrote about that lesson, calling the Post's report on it scandalized. She stated that educators have a hugely complex task when it comes to training young people to be ethical consumers of pornography. Porn literacy educators want digital natives to be able to recognize that much of modern pornography perpetuates and amplifies standards of beauty that can be harmful. They amplify a lack of protection, exploitation, sometimes sexual violence. That was the goal of the lesson at the Columbia Private School. The instructor and the Dalton School, which employed her at the time, defended the content, which they said was about body positivity, actual consent, boundary setting. They said parents misinterpreted what it was all about. So when exposure to porn is, as Brunig reports, an almost guaranteed fact of adolescent life, how should we be having conversations about porn literacy? What is the role of the school? Our guests this hour are here to discuss it. Dr. Pebble Kranz is here. Pebble is a sexual medicine specialist at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. It's always nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Delighted to be here again.
Lauren Berger is here, training coordinator for Restore Sexual Assault Services. Lauren, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me back.
And Shayla Benson is a sexologist and a senior manager of outreach and education for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. Dr. Benson, welcome. Thanks for being with us. And I can't hear Dr. Benson. We'll figure this out. We'll get that set there. But let me start in studio with our guest here. And Pebble, let me start with you.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear the report on one hand from the New York Post that parents are upset, that students are upset, that this is not the role of the school, then you read Liz Brunig's reporting and what she says, that was a sensationalized version of what this was about. And this was about simply being honest that kids are going to find porn whether we like it or not. And if we don't address how they should understand it, they're going to get some bad ideas. Where do you come down? What makes sense to you here?
I think that is my conclusion. It is young people are going to encounter porn, sexually explicit media. It's more accessible than it has ever been before. And people on average are being exposed to this when they're 11 or 12. So one thing about the article that I thought was interesting is junior in high school is a little bit late to begin that conversation. So I'm not surprised that kid was like, why should I miss my AP course for this?
She's the one who said I already know about porn.
Right. Yeah. So it's in high school. It's a bit late. It's true that it's there. It's out there. Kids, adolescents are going to get exposed to it. Are going to have encounters with it. I think there was one study that said that 88% of heterosexual cisgender boys were using porn once a week in ninth grade.
Ninth grade.
In ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
With sexual and gender minorities also using porn as well. And heterosexual cisgender girls also almost 40% using porn in ninth grade. With this kind of exposure, we need to be able to talk about literacy with regard to sexually explicit media. And what the evidence, the scientific evidence says, is that this exposure to sexually explicit media, that evidence is mixed. It doesn't say that there are all bad effects, that there are all good effects. It says that there are some youth who are using this media for important education. Sexual and gender minorities don't get any sex education from school, from parents often. And so it's an important source of education. It's also can be problematic as well, because what's available free online is filled with expectations of sex that are filled with racist and misogynistic and lack of clear consent. So we have to talk with kids about how to approach this in a literate way. And I guess, you know, the fundamental message that I have about this is we need to keep talking to our kids. We need to not use this sexually explicit media as a distractor from the fact that the issue is we need to talk to our kids and say that porn shouldn't be the standard by which we measure sex and sexuality.
And we will talk as we go throughout the hour about how our guests define porn literacy, on how they would want to educate, you know, teenagers, people who are becoming adults, to understand what they are seeing and the potential problems with it, exploitation, et cetera, consent, all of those things. So what does porn literacy mean? We'll talk about that. Lauren Berger, let me read a quote from a spokesperson for FAIR, the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. That spokesperson told the New York Post, quote, "This is all part of an orthodoxy that has taken over schools across the country. Millions of kids are being experimented on with a new curriculum that racializes and sexualizes young children, labels them by traits like skin color, gender, or sexual orientation, and tells them the paths of their lives are determined by those traits. They are just sexualized beings." Is this an experimentation on kids?
I respectfully disagree with most of that characterization. It's not necessarily leading students to a particular answer to say the thing and to give students the comprehensive information to be able to decide for themselves if these are choices that they want to make. And, you know, this analysis went toward, you know, racialization as well as sexualization. And I think, you know, both of those arenas, as far as new curricula and things being introduced in the classroom, are largely misunderstood because people are not necessarily grasping that these have been evaluated by evidence-based credentialing professionals. These are developmentally appropriate concepts that are being brought into classrooms, both from, you know, Restore's arena, as you'd say, for sexual violence prevention and response. But the other side, you know, the rest of the story is how people can form meaningful and positive connections with other people who they want to be close with, which obviously is going to be a different conversation when they are, you know, very young children versus middle school versus high school. And to give them that information is not to pigeonhole, you know, and to kind of lead them to this sort of already prescribed information that an educator is sort of trying to lead them toward. I don't see that that's happening.
Well, Dr. Shayla Benson, a sexologist and senior manager of outreach and education for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. I want to make sure we've got you there. Shayla, how are you?
I am good. How are you today?
Good. So let me just ask you if you want to weigh in as well on the notion of teaching this at all. What do you say to listeners who might argue that, look, what Dr. Kranz, what Lauren are saying, we get it. We understand that kids are going to probably encounter porn earlier than maybe parents would like them to. But, you know, some parents are going to argue that this is just not the job of schools to be teaching this, that they should be taught this, but it should be somebody else. It should be their parents. It should be somebody else. What do you say to that, Shayla?
Well, I would like to say that in addition to the schools, we actually uphold the parents and the families as being the first point of resource for sexuality education. I don't think it was ever set up for schools and places like Planned Parenthood or other community organizations that provide sexuality education to basically be the primary source for providing that type of education. So we encourage families to be askable adults, as we call them. Mm-hmm. So basically an individual that is approachable, that is informed, that is basically going to be available to that child or children in their lives and provide them the necessary resources and tools so that they can make those informed decisions for themselves.
Yeah, an approachable and available adult. You know, I can hear in my ears, I can hear the parents saying, that's us. And we've set up that relationship with mm-hmm. our kids, and we are going to be there for our kids, and it should be us. And we've cultivated that relationship. So when our kids have questions about sex, they come to us, and that is our job, not the schools. I also can hear, you know, some families, some kids saying, yeah, I get along with my parents, but I'm not going to talk to them about sex. I mean, ideally, I understand why parents or guardians might feel like this should come from us. I don't know realistically if that's right, Pebble. And when you think about literacy, porn literacy, let me ask all three of our guests, how would you define that? What would you want teenage, whatever the age is, what do you want people to understand about pornography that without education they might not understand?
Well, I think literacy in any arena is about being able to take in information in a way that is comprehensively critical of that information. So where is this information coming from? What message is being provided, and what is the genesis of this message? What is the purpose of this message? And being able to understand that, just like we have to teach young people to have sort of advertising literacy as well. You know, all of the things that you see on television about how wonderful Lucky Charms are is not all good.
It might not be the nutritional utopia that Lucky Charms says.
That's right. That's right. So I think when it comes to porn, this focus on sexually explicit media and its dangers is just this distraction, just sort of as Shayla is saying, from the problem that we're not talking to our kids as parents. We're not talking to our kids in schools about how to have not only safe sex, but satisfying and pleasurable sex. And so porn is filling the gap on those questions, that natural curiosity about pleasure and satisfaction. And if we had already talked, frankly, with our kids about not only understanding and honoring their own values, as well as honoring the natural curiosity about sex, a natural desire for pleasure, if we had already talked with them about gender diversity and sexual diversity and fluidity and the wide, wide world of what humans find pleasurable and erotic, that they have this great joy of figuring out what kind of sex it is that they want to have for their body and their individual's pleasure. If we had had those conversations, porn wouldn't have to fill the gap. So the problem, I think, is, oh, yeah, I'm an approachable adult. But if you're not comfortable with talking also about satisfaction and pleasure, you're missing a big part of the conversation, the reason that people have sex. So we might be feel like we're really approachable about contraception and STI prevention and all those things that we're scaring kids about. But we're not so good at helping people with helping young people mm-hmm. move towards the kinds of sex they want to have.
Yeah. Lauren, what does porn literacy mean in your mind?
I actually agree with a lot, you know, what you were sharing in terms of the comprehensive nature and the way that we need to understand with a critical lens, you know, what's in front of us. And speaking from the lens of Restore, some of the education that we provide regarding pornography is pretty arbitrary. The idea is that, you know, photos of people under the age of this age sure. is a crime, like those sorts of things. And, you know, the idea of missing a crucial part of the conversation is often, you know, what brings folks to these kinds of conversations where Restore is the response, where we're talking about sexual violence prevention and response, because often without a foundation of what it means to have meaningful and pleasurable sexual relationships and intimacy, and folks don't have that knowledge, and viewing porn without that context, the contextualization of that, without any literacy, there are really distorted views of what it means to be in a equitable relationship. There are very confusing ideals about bodies, ideals about consent. No one's having discussions about power and control. And the idea of focusing on, you know, who is the person, who is this content for? Who is this content being produced for? How is it positioning certain things? And that's not giving students anything that's like a value judgment on seeking out this information, but to give them the tools to analyze whether or not this is harmful content.
Yeah. Am I watching something that is exploitation, right?
Exactly.
Right. And you can understand why students wouldn't necessarily know how to understand that without the education that Lauren's talking about. Shayla, how do you sort of determine what porn literacy should be?
Well, I mean, I definitely agree with the panelists on their definitions of porn literacy. I would also like to add to that we want to provide a framework that young people can critically examine, and they're able to make and have those thoughtful dialogues and decisions that will guide them. In addition to that, when we're talking about the type of education that we want to offer our youth, we really need to see them also as teachers, because youth inform me every single day. Mm-hmm. That's how I'm able to do the work that I do. So we really need to kind of shift the paradigm, in a sense, where they're not just like participants that need to learn things, but they're also co-creators, and that will better enhance the creation and the delivering of the education that we're trying to give them that's relevant to them. Such things like normalizing their curiosities about bodies and sex. These are conversations that they crave. They're hungry for it. Mm. And if you don't have the right individuals, be it family or educators that are specialized in this type of work, then they're either going to put up the wall or they're going to find their education somewhere else. Hence why we're having this conversation today. Mm-hmm. Hence why Justine Engfante received such, you know, pushback from families with regards to what's being taught to the students. But then we're seeing the students saying, hey, not a big deal. We're watching porn every day. We want to examine and explore what are the messages behind this. And she was that person at that particular institution at the time to offer that expertise. And now the school is in a situation where I really don't know, because I don't work there, But I will say that the school is definitely missing out on a very great resource because, you know, to do this type of work, you have to be open. It's not just what's in your mind and what you know, but it also shows itself in your body language as well. So if you're not comfortable talking about these things, but you know someone else that does, then, oh, make sure that that's the person that's reaching out to our youth and having these open dialogues.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get some listener feedback because I think, well, I'm not going to say we've touched a nerve. I mean, people understand that porn is out there. It's just a question of how you present it and information about it, how you educate about it, whose job that is. That's what we're talking about with our guests this hour. And we've got some phone calls and emails already to kind of work through that I think will be instructive. Let me grab Dan in Rochester in 1 second. And I'll also just read, let me just read a little bit from what Elizabeth Brunig wrote in The Atlantic. She interviewed students, she used pseudonyms, and she took data, but also wanted to understand from the perspective of students. So when Shayla Benson tells us, sometimes it's the students educating adults, adults probably should be listening when students like Talia, who was 17 years old, this is from Liz Brunig's piece. Talia, 17 years old, told me, this is Liz Brunig writing, told me, quote, the boys that I've had sex with, I can tell while having sex with them which ones watch too much porn based on how they behave during sex. It comes across as a certain impersonal performance, she said, or they'll do certain things that I know they probably wouldn't have thought of organically, end quote. And Brunig goes on to say, I asked about the nature of those learned behaviors. Were they violent, disconcerting, uncomfortable? Talia said, quote, when I first started having sex, I thought that it was just because of watching porn and also listening to other people my age talk about sex, the weird ubiquity of BDSM culture, I thought I was just supposed to like being choked and stuff, end quote. 17 years old. Ubiquitous. Choking. Things like that. If you are not aware, your kids probably are, and that's can be hard for people, but that's part of what this conversation's about. Dan in Rochester. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. I'm a private provider, and so I talk to parents regularly about these issues. And so today I was talking to a parent and trying to explain to them that the 11-year-old boy was already seeing porn. You know, I talk to parents of very young children, alerting them about the ubiquity of phones and the fact that they're already taking pictures of themselves and posting them. And so when you take a picture today with a phone, you know, it moves. And so parents don't understand that if a child takes a picture of their junk and sends it to a friend, which they can just do through AirDrop, it doesn't have to go through a server. They have actually broken a federal law. They've produced pornography. And if they then send it to a friend, they have distributed childhood pornography. So while parents certainly have to be a key part of this, they don't even know what pornography really is. They're thinking, I need to talk to my 17-year-old about this. When many kids are already sexually mature, especially our girls with early puberty, much, much earlier. I routinely ask, have you had any dick pics yet?
All right.
And,
well,
you know, 7-year-old girls are getting dick pics.
Let's use a different term, Dan. I appreciate that. But let's at least ask if there's a concern. Well, Lauren, you brought up concerns on the legal side of things. Do parents need to know or at least talk to kids about the fact that if you're sharing sexual imagery, especially at a certain age, there can be real consequences?
I think it's absolutely an important part, you know, of a much larger conversation. And the fact of the matter is, you know, every photo, every piece of media that is depicting, you know, someone under the age of 18 in a sexual nature, either naked or in like other, like if things are, you know, like a wet t-shirt, anything, it doesn't even necessarily have to be naked, but in a sexual explicit nature, every photo, every piece of media is its own charge. every time it is sent is its own charge. And while that is definitely an important thing to be mindful of, it's definitely not necessarily the entire conversation, because we also know that, you know, if someone is, quote unquote, producing child pornography of themselves, you know, the likelihood that they're going to go to federal prison at age 12 is very small. But the fact that it technically is, you know, the transgression of this law, and that they could be, you know, made an example of, or that absolutely could be a thing that is carried out through the court system, is definitely something to, again, be aware of. But even beyond that is, what are the other consequences of having a photo that you meant to share with perhaps one person in confidence with that person, and then maybe that person decides they want to share it with someone else, and then it's sort of anyone's, you know, guess in terms of where that photo is going to go, who's going to save it, who's going to share it, who's going to upload it somewhere else. And now, you know, all of these folks are engaging in explicit media depicting a child, you know, so this, the federal criminal aspect of it can spider out pretty quickly. But for that survivor, it's now about how they're going to heal, how they're going to go about feeling emotionally safe, how they're going to foster meaningful connections with folks again. So often a compliment to the conversation around, you know, this is a federal crime, is also, you know, if you make the choice to share photos of yourself, we are not here to shame you. We are not here to blame you. Because the idea that children or young people in relationships will share photos of themselves is something that happens. Adults do those things. And it's not uncommon for me to even bring up in a high school setting, you know, that there were, you know, explicit photographs being exchanged as soon as there were pictures. You know, during the Civil War, there were photos like that, you know, because there were pictures, they existed. So that happened. And so the idea that this is not something that, you know, because you did it, you deserve these things. No. And the idea that we can support our friends who are going through these things as a survivor. And there's actually even some legal movement there in different states as they talk about what's called revenge porn laws, where like sharing someone's photo without permission, even, you know, in those sorts of respects. So yes, the idea that it's a federal crime is definitely a component, and folks absolutely should be aware of that, especially if they're going to be, you know, on devices that are in your home or that you're paying for, those kinds of things, as far as a liability. But there's absolutely much more to the conversation.
Yeah, I just have to say, I mean, I can understand entirely the notion of media literacy, sexual literacy, porn literacy, including very direct conversation with kids, teens. If someone sends you, if a friend of yours, or if it's going around school, here's a picture of somebody, usually a girl, not always, nude picture, and it comes to you, here's the ethical thing to do. Here's how you behave. Here's what you don't do. Those conversations, because those pictures are spreading, whether you want to believe it or not. And boy, it can be so damaging, not to mention illegal, as exactly Lauren says. Some of the pushback we're getting, let me read some of that. Kathy writes to say, I respectfully disagree with your guests on some points. We talk to our kids about good nutrition and health for bodies, and Captain Crunch ads. Captain Crunch ads will win out every time. Porn is probably marketed at least as well as many poor food choices. So while I think parents need to talk to kids about it, and I think sexual education needs to be an integral part of any school, I would want to emphasize the consumer objectification, false advertising, profit-driven aspect of porn, not to portray it as a way to figure out how great sex can be. That's from Kathy. What do you think, Pebble?
Well, that's a viewpoint that I think a lot of people share. The scientific literature, the social science literature, has evidence that there are some young people who are using sexually explicit media to understand their sexuality, and explore their sexuality in a positive way. There was another study that I was reading about that indicated that while young people who are watching sexually explicit media may have some more behaviors that they might not come to on their own exploration organically, just as the article says. They have an opportunity, if they're watching sexually explicit media in a critical way, to say, that is not what I want to happen. Or, maybe that is something that I would like to explore. And if it's well-produced sexually explicit media, there is consent involved. And I do want to say this. There is ethically produced sexually explicit media. Ethical porn. There is porn that is produced with people who are clearly documented adults that are engaging in safer sex practices, that are using explicit consent as a part of the storyline, that prioritize women's pleasure as a part of the storyline. So this is out there. It's mostly not the free stuff that's available to kids. So this is also part of the problem. The stuff that is widely ubiquitous and accessible is some problematic stuff, really problematic stuff, but it's not necessarily sexual media that is the problem.
Let me turn to Shayla. And Shayla, we had another piece of dissent from a listener, Laura in Rochester. She says she thinks it's disgusting that this panel is trying to justify exposing children to sexual content. She thinks it's not only offensive, but it is akin to grooming. I think all three of our guests will have something to say about that. Shayla, what do you think?
Yeah, it's the wording is very interesting. I don't think that we are exposing them. They are finding this out on their own, whether we want to agree with it or not.
Right.
I mean, I joke around with folks and I tell them, gone are the days of the Playboy premium channels that were hard to access, you know, via cable. These kids have access to a lot of things now. And, you know, I can see kids as young as, you know, 8 and 9 years old having access to cellular phones, which means they can access plenty of things for free now. So the question then becomes, what do we do about that? Because it's not going anywhere. And I feel like this is a recurring thing that we've been mentioning each and every time. I think a lot of adults think that if we just kind of sweep it under the rug or put it in the closet, that it will go away. And it doesn't go away. So then how do we address these concerns? Again, how do we have this open dialogue? How do we address other aspects of sexuality that are not addressed in porn? How do we discuss bodily autonomy, agency, consent, anatomy, pleasure, and much, much more. So.
Okay. Lauren Berger, you had a visceral reaction when I read Laura's comment that she thought the notion of exposing kids to porn, even in an educational setting, is akin to grooming.
I did. That caused a drop of the jaw for me on that, because grooming is a term that we'll often use at Restore to describe behaviors by somebody who has a predatory notion and who has an end game, and that end game is to sexually harm someone. And so they will undertake sort of grooming behaviors to manipulate that person and their environment. And what we are trying to, I guess, justify is the collaborative nature of what comprehensive sex education ought to be, to not only to speak to my personal professional realm of sexual violence prevention and response, but the second half or the rest of the story, which is to form actual meaningful positive relationships, which ought to be something that all of the spheres of influence in a student's life are taking part in. And that's not something that anyone on this panel is begrudging. But what does happen when those conversations are denied and we say we're not going to talk about those things, that doesn't happen here, that's not something that we're going to deal with, and so we're just going to forget about it and put our fingers in our ears and act like this doesn't exist. Then we have folks who absolutely do have predatory behavior in mind and who are engaging in grooming behavior and are all too ready to tell these children that already are experiencing a lot of different communities online as far as gaming, social media, and even searching specifically for pornography, which one of the educational programs that Restore is certified to provide, the research behind that program is actually children as young as 7 years old are specifically searching for pornography online. And there are people who are all too ready to provide the information that they want them to have when other spheres are either not willing or not permitted, you know, to provide the comprehensive information that actually does have the best interest of the student in mind.
Dr. Kranz, what did you make of it when Laura used the word grooming?
I couldn't have said it better, actually. I think that this is a really scary topic for people. And I get that. And I think there is this whole extra layer of shame and fear when it comes to things around sexuality. And this makes it super complicated. I don't know that shame of any kind leads to healthy behaviors or situations. And this is certainly true of sexual shame. When somebody feels that their pursuit of pleasure, no matter what their age, is a scary, dirty, bad thing that makes them a bad person, I think that that leads people to a place where they can be exploited, and it leads people to a place where they exploit because they consider themselves a bad person when they're not. They're just a human being who has a drive for pleasure like we all do. You know, and I want to go back to something that Shayla said about the languaging that is really a problem. And I noticed that I used this languaging too about being exposed when it's really, yes, it's accessing. It is there and we need to deal with it and share our values with our kids. Mainly, this is an opportunity to share not only principles for their health and wellness, but our own values with our kids when we have these conversations, when we recognize the reality that they're going to be accessing sexual media because they have phones and computers.
Well, Sheila is an educator who says grooming, educating students on the realities of porn, it's acting, it's not real, is not grooming kids for anything other than setting good boundaries for their own bodies and setting standards for their own types of sexual contact. Not educating kids about sex is not preparing them for a world where it is constantly present. That's from Sheila. After we take our only break of the hour, I'll address a couple of emails we've got. One email asking, you know, how much is... I think people want to know the mechanics of it. If we're going to educate about porn, people want to know the mechanics of it. In other words, people are asking, are you showing actual porn in high school? I mean, is that, what would you do? Where do you draw the line? So we can talk about that. We've got some other emails as well. On the other side of this only short break, we've got Dr. Pebble Kranz, who's a sexual medicine specialist at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Lauren Berger is training coordinator for Restore Sexual Assault Services. Shayla Benson is a sexologist and a senior manager of outreach and education for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. And we'll right back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, the best and the worst American cities to live in if you don't own a car. We examine both ends of that and take a look at Rochester's place on the list. In our second hour, the Rochester Cocktail Revival is coming back, the longest such event for cocktail culture in the state. We'll talk about what cocktail culture means in Rochester Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and working through some feedback here, one of our listeners was asking about how much porn you would actually show in an educational setting, essentially saying, if I'm open to this, if we're gonna include in sex education pornography literacy, with all the best intentions, making sure students understand exploitation, the perils of an industry that has done a lot wrong, but also, as Dr. Krantz says, understanding that there might be ethical pornography out there that could be potentially more helpful and not quite as harmful, they're wondering, what are you showing in the classroom? So, Shayla Benson, let me start with you. What are the boundaries there? How much are you actually showing?
Well, in terms of pornography, we're not showing actual porn clips or films in the classroom. That's usually not how it goes.
Yeah, I think that's what the listeners are wondering, honestly. Yeah, yeah. I think listeners are wondering if you're showing clips of porn in the classroom. You're saying no.
No.
Okay.
No. There are actual discussions being had. A lot of my colleagues within the field of sexual health are creating curriculums. Mm-hmm. There actually is an example of a curriculum that is available for folks if they want to teach about porn literacy. I believe the co-creators are Emily Rothman and Jess Alder.
Right.
And it is a porn literacy curriculum that explores a variety of different topics, from, you know, actual talking about pornography, to the history of sexually explicit images, to healthy intimacy, to healthy flirting, dating, and caring for other people. So it's not just focused specifically on the mechanics of sex and sexual behavior and what goes where and how does that work. Yes, we are talking about pornography and the effect that it's having on our students, whereby which we are engaging them in a discussion, an open discussion, which again is what they want. But we're also bringing to light how all of that intersects with different concepts and different things that they encounter every day as adolescents and young adults.
Okay. Dr. Krantz, how would you answer the listener's question about how you'd present this material?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Dr. Rothman's curriculum. It's the Stay Strong curriculum through the Boston Public Health system. And they are very clear that they never show porn as a part of the curriculum, that it's helping young people define their values and be able to make choices. There was some evidence around this curriculum that it increased, and I don't have this exactly right here, increased ability to make choices about the kinds of sex the young people wanted to have. It increased their ability to communicate around safer sex. These are the outcomes we want. The other thing that I love about the Stay Strong curriculum too is that, just as Shayla was saying earlier, it was created with youth. It was driven by youth helping create this curriculum. Really not at all. I can't imagine being able to productively have a forum where kids could really figure out their values about something, where they were inundated with images.
Okay. Lauren, agree?
Absolutely. And I mean, as Restore, we don't typically present specifically about, you know, pornography.
Sure.
and those nuances, but there's a lot of around like the revenge porn aspect and things being shared outside of a consensual context. And there's one actual 90-second YouTube video that we love to show in classrooms. And if folks want to know what it is, you just go to YouTube and you search "So You Did a Thing," and then the word thorn, because that's the creators. And it's actually as a cartoon with cats, but it talks about sexploitation.
Oh, interesting. Opal writes, I pity the trans teenager who is left turning to porn to understand anything about their gender. The ability to apply critical skills would least help to dull the negative psychological impact of finding out that you as a person are little more than a fetish object to much of the internet. Yeah, that
for sure.
Yeah, that can be.
Yeah. So I think for having a way of looking at sexual media that helps guide people to feeling affirmed rather than feeling fetishized, which certainly can happen with a lot of that free, ubiquitous, open access porn, is really important. But there's a problem here that sexual and gender minority students are not getting much education about their own sexuality in a healthy way. And so, unfortunately, again, porn is filling the gap.
Let me read a couple more emails. Anna from Rochester shares, when I was in college, I was sleeping with different partners. I was 18 years old and found out that someone who I was sleeping with lied about being tested for STDs. I went to the nurse's office at my college, which is in Rochester, and was visibly upset and worried. I explained my situation, and instead of supporting me, the nurse said, well, you should have known this could happen. You didn't know him that well after all. Then, instead of asking if I was okay, she slid over a card to the college for the college therapist and told me to call them. I'm glad I was a strong person who knew she was in the wrong, but this shaming could push people away with less self-confidence. I fear for young women that receive this type of harsh criticism, particularly those who come from backgrounds where they don't feel safe talking to any adults about sexual experiences. Sorry you went through that, Anna. And Barbara in Wheatland says, I think sex education should be taught in high school, possibly as early as ninth grade. It's been decades since I was in high school, so I'm not sure how it works there now. Teens need to be taught to respect their partner, not to engage in sexual activity lightly, and obviously be informed of the consequences in engaging in sexual activity, such as disease transmission and pregnancy. I think it's very important that the students are taught in a non-co-ed class setting. It's easier for them to ask questions of the teacher and will feel less intimidated if they do not have the opposite sex sitting in the room with them. That's from Barbara. Let me ask all three of you about that. Dr. Krantz, what would you say to Barbara?
Well, I think I am glad that you're endorsing the idea of comprehensive sex education. That is wonderful. I think that making some assumptions about gender and comfort of students in that way may miss a comfortable place for a lot of young people. And I'm not saying that very well. Maybe somebody else can say it better. But, you know, one little tidbit that I'd like to share that you were saying early, like ninth grade. Well, there was a 30-year study of comprehensive sex education recently published in 2020 that really shows that a multi-level starting very early as kids are bringing the topic to their trusted adults, as early as possible. We really need to be starting to have conversations about sex much, much earlier than ninth grade. Ninth grade is really for a lot of kids when the train has already met its first destination or two, not only left the station. We really need to think about starting comprehensive sex education much earlier.
Okay. Lauren, how would you respond to Barbara, who says, make sure it's just no co-ed education on the subject?
Well, I'm glad that Barbara, you know, was able to share her thoughts, and certainly that could be an option, you know, that might work for some students. In the programs that Restore facilitates, we typically go for, you know, the co-ed mixed audience, all genders, you know, and that's really helpful for students to hear the variety of perspectives. And, you know, to speak about the introduction of this material, you know, New York State actually passed a law last school year, Aaron's Law, that mandated sexual abuse prevention education in grades kindergarten through 8. And so students are already receiving information on, you know, emotional literacy and identifying trusted adults. And so it makes sense that the natural next step, again, even at that young age, would then be about how to form positive and loving relationships, you know, with people that they care about. And, you know, it, again, there may be some students that want to have a space where it's, you know, students who identify as male are grouped together and they're talking about, you know, the guy stuff. And that's certainly one option, but it wouldn't necessarily be ideal for it to be the only option.
Okay. And Dr. Benson, in our last 45 seconds, I'll just ask you if you think that we are going to see, as the New York Post was reporting on, more programs like this taught in various schools. Is this happening?
I would definitely say yes. Our students now, our youth, our adolescents, they are very, very vocal about their needs and their wants. And especially if it's with a trusted individual, they will definitely make it known to the public that we need more education on these topics. We know what we are receiving, and that's been okay so far, but now we need to expand that so that we have a more holistic view of what comprehensive sexuality education can and be.
I want to thank our guests for the conversation this hour. Dr. Benson is a sexologist and senior manager of outreach and education for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. Shayla, thanks for making time for the program today.
Thank you.
Lauren Berger, training coordinator for Restore Sexual Assault Services. Nice having you back here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Pebble Kranz, sexual medicine specialist at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Dr. Kranz, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, thanks for joining the conversation. Couldn't get through all the feedback. A lot of feedback on this subject. For the whole team here and for Mike Black Engineering today, thank you, Mike. Emma Raystein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.